Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with Gilbert Sells, brother of the radical journalist George Sells, who wrote in a foreword to a translation he made of Aristophanes' Lysistrata in 1934 that Aristophanes had described in his earlier play, The Knights, the eternal demagogue, scoundrel and profiteer, who makes his appearance in every war and persuades his countrymen not only that all patriotism has descended upon him, but that all patriotism must flow out of him, and that to reject him is to be disloyal and traitorous. And that is sort of a prologue into something I wrote, Fear and Loathing in Trump's America. My friend Max says the R's, by which he means the current crop of American usurpers, who have spent the past half century destroying the average American's faith in his and her own government so that none of us will look to government to bring us out of peasantry. They venture to convince us that government is the enemy and that they are the only force that can save us, they being the new aristocracy of corporatism, unmentioned in the Constitution, but wholeheartedly advocated by so-called strict constructionists. Max also says the R's have successfully promoted the desocialization of society, that we are all alone trying to make the best we can instead of being part of a cooperative and mutually interdependent society. The middle class nearly gone, fringe desperation succeeds unified political action. And of course, those who create the whirlwind ignore the consequences of what they are doing, onerously criticizing their critics as traitors. Yet they hope to get all they can while they can and let some other poor fools, the rest of us, whom they have set up for the sure certainty, to reap the devaluation. Max says we have come a long way from the man who said that all we have to fear is fear itself, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, to the man who says the fear works for him, Donald Trump, of course. It might be useful to think of Donald Trump and his White House as a criminal conspiracy to take over and use the federal government for their own conspirational purposes. As Clarence Darrow once said, of a group of crooked 19th century railroad CEOs. Trump and his corrupt entourage are committing what might very well be considered a monumental tragedy upon the American people, dissolving constitutional democracy to conform to the dictates of his own self-obsessed lust for tyrannical power, which depends on throttling the Bill of Rights and abolishing civil liberties in the USA as initial priorities in a plutocratic inquisition. Only a few laws prevent the Trumpanistas from grotesque excesses such as occurred in Germany in the 1930s, but they have been vehemently slashing at the rule of law since Trump's abominable inauguration. The Trumpian premise that one political party, with himself as party Führer, can take complete power and shut out every other political option in the premise that only one ideology is necessary, that of blood and soil right-wing nationalism, is the most dangerous aspect of current politics in the United States. Ideology is powerful, especially when blind and pandering to ignorance and fear as well as exclusion. Coupled with conspicuous avarice and racial and class prejudice, it is a recipe for the disenfranchisement of ordinary Americans, whose lives and welfare clearly deteriorate as a result of reactionary political and economic repression. Yet despite blatant bureaucratic ineptitude and criminal malignity at virtually every level of Trump's adversarial idiocracy, many Americans seem willingly indoctrinated by right-wing disinformation that so-called socialistic governance by liberal left-wing government has ripped them off and corrupted their Yankee Doodle virtue with godless secularism and pervasive cultural and racial diversity. The speciously sophistic advent of Trump in collusion with oppositional collaboration by Russia in particular is presumptively determined to manipulate constitutional democracy into despotic circumcision. Separation of church and state is not only consistently blurred, but corrupted to serve state power, which is a major transgression against the fabric of American secular democracy. The moral values elicited by Trump from the inception of his presidential campaign were exceedingly narrow, certainly not above the immorality of waging preemptive wars or the escalating disparity of wealth garnered through unfair taxation, wage freezes, and union busting, not to mention coercive political influence. Morality to ultra-conservatives is essentially about abortion, homosexuality, and their own personal reverent misogyny and gender chauvinism, mostly male-inspired. These patent pieties miss the big point, a cash economy that has a single purpose of enrichment of a privileged class corrupts the moral foundations of a society, and also, in our case, devalues our treasured civil rights and liberties of ordinary, non-rich Americans. So are these ugly injustices and the contemptuous treachery of election fraud and collusion with foreign intrusion, plus varied other obstructions of the electoral, political, and legal processes of American democracies, enough to consider impeachment of Trump? Do the Trumpians in particular fit the declamation that they readily apply to those who oppose them, that they are themselves, in flow-blown definition of the word, traitors to the values and purposes of democracy? After all, Trump and his abominable co-conspirators are recklessly obliterating the substance of democracy while facetiously pontificating its core values. They are stealing the country from its people, subjecting them to contemptible fraud and deceit. Donald Trump is most likely, in the coarsest manner, a traitor to the USA, but it probably does not matter to him because the only treachery he recognizes is personal betrayal of himself. Trump and his atavistic co-avatars feverishly dismantle our already jeopardized democracy, snubbing legal norms constituted to prevent, or at least restrict, such usurpation by domestic pariahs consumed by Olympian avarice, which makes it the prerequisite of the ordinary people of the United States to stand up to Trump and his perfidious sycophants, who have been erroneously allowed to ravage our democracy and the lives of its citizens, immigrants, and refugees. One of America's most famous politicians, Henry Clay, said of Andrew Jackson, whom Trump rates second only to his own presidency, quote, "Except for an enormous fabric of executive power for himself, the president has built up nothing, constructed nothing, and will leave no enduring monument of his administration. He goes for destruction, universal destruction, and it seems to be his greatest ambition to efface and obliterate every trace of the wisdom of his predecessors." And that was Henry Clay. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, elected four times, said 80 years ago on November 4th, 1938, "But I venture the challenging statement that if American democracy ceases to move forward as a living force, seeking day and night by peaceful means to better the lot of our citizens, then fascism and communism, aided unconsciously perhaps by old line Tory republicanism, will grow in strength in our land." To dethrone Trump and his repulsive gaggle of petty grafters, bunco artists, grave robbers, and purse snatchers who have aided and abetted his rape of American democracy, impeach him first at home, establishing felonious atrocities against the Constitution, his most pernicious, his attempted burglary of the American soul, and afterward remand him to the world court for the rest of humanity to judge. And that is something I wrote, Fear and Loathing in Trump's America. And now, from an old friend I've known at least 50 years and who is 2 days older than me, David Horowitz, Professor Emeritus of History at Portland State University. He wrote a little note saying that he recently gave a talk to a group of senior volunteer educators on 1920s KKK, Ku Klux Klan in Oregon, and brought it up to today's white nationalism. And he offers his conclusion. And this is what I'm going to read. Conclusion to the 1920s Oregon KKK, a case study of resistance amid rising white nationalism in the age of Trump. The response to the 1922 Oregon Compulsory School Initiative offers an instructive example of effective mobilization against prejudice and extremism. Even after the failure to prevent a dispiriting defeat at the polls, the Archdiocese took the lead in resubmitting the issue to public opinion while organizing a successful judicial review of the measure's constitutionality. The genius of the campaign lay in its appeal to commonly shared American principles rather than a narrow focus on the needs and priorities of a selected constituency. It shows that the defense of humane values in the face of demeaning and destructive creeds and behavior can be done confidently without panic. Americans seeking to counter pseudo-populists who attack tolerance and civil discourse could draw valuable lessons from the resistance to the 1920s Ku Klux Klan mounted by principled and pragmatic opponents. Having said that, we are now confronted with the threat of unstable but well-armed loners who translate dark conspiracies and hate speech emanating from the internet and White House into deadly acts of violence. First, we must acknowledge that checks on the unlimited sale of automatic weapons, bump stocks, and high-capacity magazines may surface in the future, but are not imminent. Second, the toxic right-wing propaganda industry that propels such hate is not vulnerable to economic pressure because it sustains itself by marketing survivalist supplies or its own brand of products. Third, the nation's leader will never assume accountability for the fear-laced language he uses to pump up the 35% to 40% of the electorate he fashions as his base. Fourth, although loving and caring for one another is essential to sustaining morale, it's not a political solution to our challenges. What responses does this leave those of us who cherish a tolerant and humane society in which, as Franklin Roosevelt once said, we all go up or we all go down? I take Barack Obama's address to Howard University's class of 2016 as a useful guide. Participation in the electoral process to affect the levers of power, voting, but also financial donations to candidates across the country, support for organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU that hire good lawyers to protect civil society, and a willingness to communicate goals in an even-handed and conciliatory manner that honors the needs and values of the nation's majority. Above all, as educators, we must keep in mind that a belief in rational discourse delivered with quiet but self-confident and firm determination is the first antidote to encroaching authoritarianism. As Mark Twain once quipped, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And that was something David Horowitz wrote. And I'd like to read something else he wrote that he actually sent me a while back. Getting It Together for 2020 by David A. Horowitz. Let's get it done. With a quote by Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin's cousin. I've learned the invaluable lesson that in the practical activities of life, no man can tender the highest service unless he can act in combination with his fellows, which means a certain amount of give and take. Nothing gets accomplished if we do not work through practical methods and with a readiness to face life as it is and not as we think it ought to be. It's essential that the Democrats have the right kind of candidate in 2020. What scares me is the prospect of a narrowly focused echo chamber progressive who will put off the Midwestern and independently minded voters who are essential to building a viable electoral coalition. That doesn't mean a candidate has to run away from popular progressive values and policies. It's more a case of how they come across to voters. My concept of a challenger in the age of Trump borrows from the spirit of surprise in Saul Alinsky's Mass Jiu-Jitsu. A presidential candidate with positive values and policies and a determined sense of personal will and fervor, but with a steady, calmly confident, and reassuring demeanor that delivers a change up to verbal histrionics and addresses the country's desire for healing and the need to end cynical political games. The antidote to Trumpism is not a belligerent street fighter who validates back and forth name calling, but a quiet but determined voice, perhaps a female version of Jimmy Stewart or Gary Cooper. To this end, my wife Gloria and I both came to the conclusion some time ago that senior Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar would be the inspiring national candidate who creates the bridge between progressives and electoral majority. Klobuchar is a former Minneapolis district attorney who now serves on both the Senate Judiciary and Intelligence Committees and is deeply committed to preserving the integrity of the American electoral system from foreign interference or domestic voter suppression. Klobuchar often focuses on kitchen table issues like opioid abuse and consumer product safety. She was ranked first in the Senate in 2016 for sponsoring or co-sponsoring bills enacted into law and prides herself on an ability to compromise and work with opponents. Yet she has earned the highest ratings from the ACLU, NARAL, and Working Mother magazine and has a solid record in support of health care, Wall Street regulation, inclusive immigration policy, and common sense gun safety measures, as well as opposition to privileged tax cuts and conservative court appointees. Despite her distinguished record, however, Klobuchar comes off as a fresh face on the national scene, free of the taint of politics as usual. It's also important to note that Minnesota is located in the Midwestern battleground that will decide the next presidential election. It's the Midwest, stupid, may well turn out to be the memorable staff mantra of this next campaign. At the same time, adding New Jersey Senator Cory Booker as the vice presidential nominee can add some extra fire to the mix and serve as a shout out to the party's loyal African American base. Let's get it done. And that was by David Horowitz. And now back to something that I wrote, something else I should say that I wrote. As the nation moves farther away from its valediction of George Herbert Walker Bush, it might be apt to remember that the qualities that seemed to be attached to his presidency and to him personally were not quite matched by his son and namesake's character in the same position. George W. Bush Jr. was declared the 43rd president of the USA on December 12, 2000, because the United States Supreme Court voted 5-4 to discontinue the disputed vote in Florida. Pundits immediately dubbed him the president-select. That was the second time a father and son had become president, the first duo being John and John Quincy Adams, and also the second time the Republican Party stole Florida in a presidential election. The first time was the United States centennial year of 1876. Rutherford, known forever afterward as Ruther Fraud, B. Hayes, the grand old party, GOP, candidate, won the presidency by one electoral vote. The 1876 election was at the time compared to Louis Napoleon's seizure of the government of France, destroying the faltering republic and crowning himself Napoleon III. He was the original Napoleon's nephew. There were accusations and fears of a coup d'etat when President Ulysses Grant sent federal troops to Florida, South Carolina, and Louisiana, the three remaining states with carpetbag governments in the old defeated Confederacy to bolster the occupying Union forces that had been there since the end of the Civil War 11 years earlier. Two of those states probably voted for the Democrat candidate Samuel J. Tilden in the popular vote. Nationally, Tilden received a quarter of a million more votes than Hayes and 184 electoral votes to Hayes's 165, only one short of victory. 20 electoral votes, South Carolina's 7, Louisiana's 8, Florida's 4, and one of our own state of Oregon's were in doubt. Tilden needed only one of them to win, and Hayes needed all 20. Florida might have gone for Hayes, but similar to the 2000 election, the Supreme Court denied a recount. The 1876 election wound up in Congress, which appointed an electoral commission that by one vote considered Hayes had won the presidency by a single electoral vote. Aside from fraudulent disenfranchisement of newly eligible votes by blacks freed from slavery a decade earlier and granted citizenship through the 13th, 14th, and 15th Civil War amendments to the Constitution, and Oregon's two disputed slates of electoral votes, one with two GOP and one Democrat, the other all three GOP, Tilden accepted the corrupt and truly partisan decision, although many of his supporters feared another civil war. God save the Republic was a fervent prayer. This bitterest, longest, and most controversial presidential election in American history, in the words of Paul F. Bowler, Jr., author of Presidential Elections, lasted from Wednesday, November 8, 1876, to Friday, March 2, 1877. And in somewhat of an irony, the days of both years corresponded to the new millennial years, 2000 to 2001. Kevin Phillips, who has written several histories of American politics, said that stealing Florida once was bad enough. Stealing it twice was an irrevocable stain, quote unquote, on the Republican Party's reputation. Echo a possible third time in 2018's midterm election. The razor-thin 2000 presidential race cast a cold eye on voting irregularities generally obscured with wider margins. Problems with local and state election laws, methods, and county procedures, and with national news polling. Congress claimed to conduct a blue ribbon commission, are they any other color, to recommend reforms and attempt to either reform or abolish the Electoral College, which has been tried with zero success multiple times. Though never conclusively proven, but widely suspected then and now, was that Bush Jr. and his brother Jeb, who was governor of Florida, and Florida's Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, who was also a Bush campaign manager, saw a one-time window of opportunity in Florida's election laws and practices and stole the election from Al Gore. The 2004 re-election of G.W. Bush did not smell much better. Bush campaign ads called his Democratic opponent, John Forbes Kerry, a traitor because of his very public involvement with Vietnam veterans against the war in the early 1970s. The same sort of hardcore political partisans who hijacked the 2000 election continued to seize the low ground, accusing anyone who opposed the GOP as betraying God and country. Kerry's Vietnam War record, for which he received a Silver Star and a couple of Purple Hearts, was ruthlessly maligned by Republican hired mercenaries who claimed to be Vietnam veterans. In particular, a political assassin named Jerome Corsi, who figures quite prominently in the corrupt and maliciously deceitful victory of Donald Trump's presidential campaign in 2016 as a conduit between Russian intrusion in the election on behalf of Trump and WikiLeaks leakage of stolen Democratic files, which Trump publicly urged to be done. Corsi's vile political trickery against Kerry came to be known as swift voting because of Kerry's Vietnam service aboard Navy River Patrol craft, akin to the World War II PT boats on which the original JFK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, served aboard. Kerry's political record as Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts and as U.S. Senator was not as dramatic as his war record, but it was clean and creditable. The contention over Kerry's war record and his subsequent opposition to that war served mainly as a smokescreen to obscure Bush Jr.'s choice to avoid war service and the reality that his self-description as war president, as commander-in-chief of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan following 9/11, belie the possibility of his being justifiably classified as a war deserter, more than a year AWOL from his Texas Air National Guard unit during the Vietnam War. Perhaps too much emphasis was placed upon what Bush and Kerry did in a war that ended three decades earlier, but how each personally responded to that war illuminates the character of each. Both Bush and Kerry were sons of privilege. Kerry, who staked his life at war, seemed to have regarded his privilege as a debt and attempted to provide some payment. Bush primarily manipulated his privilege as a way to dodge obligation and pursue wealth in dubious financial and political gamesmanship. In 2004, the United States was engaged in two wars, and Kerry certainly possessed far more clarity about war's costs and consequences than war-dodging Bush Jr., who acted out at the time the deceptive and contradictory role as a chicken hawk. In the manner of George Orwell, who wrote a very critical epitaph of Mohandas Gandhi after his 1948 assassination, compared to G.W. Bush in 2004, John Kerry smelled so much cleaner. This is Michael McCusker. This past Monday, December 10th, was the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which were adopted by the United Nations General Assembly on that date in 1948. And this Saturday is the 227th anniversary of the ratification of the Bill of Rights to the United States Constitution in 1791, America's secular 10 commandments.